guys. You are listening to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, administrator. And I'm joined by a survivor of the Oklahoma City bombing and a member of the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee, V.Z. Lawton. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
8 years ago today.
Yep. About 8 years ago today, I was at the St. Anthony Hospital getting my eyes fleshed out.
You were inside the building when the bombing took place?
Yeah, I was sitting there at my desk signing some papers. Oddly enough, change of beneficiary documents on life insurance policy from this lady's ex-husband, her children, worked with me there. And I felt the building start shaking. Lights went out and debris started falling on my desk. And something hit me in the back of the head and knocked me out before the truck bomb went off. I never heard the truck bomb.
Well, now, that's a pretty interesting thing to say. I guess maybe we should back up just a little bit. Timothy McVeigh was put to death almost 2 years ago now. And right. I think probably a lot of people, you know, with what you just said about you were knocked out before the truck bomb ever went off, well, I thought there only was a truck bomb. And if McVeigh's dead, what is there to investigate?
Well, there were other explosive devices in that building. The building was coming down before the truck bomb went off. And I'm not the only one that experienced that sensation. A lot of them that experienced it didn't get knocked out. They felt the building start shaking first, and then they heard the truck bomb go off. So it wasn't just me that had that experience. Of course, the government says that McVeigh was the only one that was involved. We had witness after witness that saw him with another person, Middle Easterners.
How many people saw him with John Doe number 2 or 3 or?
Oh, Rodney Johnson was driving by. He had to slam on his brakes on his pickup truck to keep from running over the John Doe 2 and McVeigh when they were leaving the truck. That's one guy. Gary Less at the worked at the Journal Record building north of the Murrah building saw the Yellow Mercury leave with McVeigh in it and John Doe 2 in there with him. And the John Doe 2 that got out of the truck walking across the street went over and got into a brown Chevy pickup with two other John Doe 2s.
So we're up to John Doe 4 and 5 now, right?
Yeah, right. And Jermaine Johnston, when she was walking, after she got out of the building, she saw we were going to be going back in. She walked south from across the street from the YMCA there, straight south down that alley. And McVeigh stopped her and asked her, said, "Were you in the building when it blew up?" She said, "Yeah, I was." And he said, "Well, were very many people killed?" She said, "Yeah, a lot of people were killed." And I asked her, I said, "Well, when you were talking to McVeigh, was there anybody else there with him?" She said, "Yeah, there was another guy there with him." I said, "Did you get a good look at him?" She said, "Oh, I really didn't." Said, "I just knew this together." So there's another witness that saw him. David Snyder saw him down on South Oklahoma there going through Bricktown. Mike Moreau saw him up at 10th and Hudson.
Mike Moreau, now he's the guy at the tire shop who gave them directions to the building, right?
Johnny's Tires, right, at 10th and Hudson. And, so, you know, they're just witness after witness that saw him. And here's something that we didn't get into our book that I wish we have, that we just didn't, we didn't have it in time to do it. There's a lady that worked for the Traveler's Aid Bureau here. She was the manager of the Traveler's Aid Bureau, as a matter of fact, and which was a block and a half west of the Murrah building. And on the 18th of April, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, she has McVeigh coming into her office with three other guys, and they're trying to get money, and they wouldn't give them any money, so they created kind of a rhubarb there. Three other employees come up to the front, which makes it four of them that saw McVeigh in that office that afternoon at 3 o'clock. When he's, according to the government, he's up there at Gary State Fishing Lake in Kansas building the bomb.
You know, Aldous Huxley once said that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you mad. And I wonder, you know, if there's all these John Doe 3, 4, 5s, and 6s running around here with Timothy McVeigh, do we know who these people are? Have you guys been able to find out who they are and what connection they have to McVeigh, and what was their role in this?
We've got some suspicions. Jana Davis, who was the reporter for the NBC affiliate here in Oklahoma City, Channel 4, she ran the information down, and she said that this Hussein Al Husseini, he thinks, was the John Doe 2 in the truck with McVeigh when it pulled up in front of the building.
Hussein Al Husseini. Now, that name sounds familiar for some reason.
Okay, he's the guy that took off and went over, and they stopped him in London and sent him back. He had some stuff in his satchel that was a little suspicious looking that he explained away, evidently. And later on, he filed a lawsuit against Channel 4 and Jana Davis and Brad Edwards, who's another reporter. And they tied her up and shut her up for about 3 or 4 years, but he didn't really have a case. So the judge just dismissed it. And she still says that he was the one that was involved.
He was the guy driving the brown pickup truck, right?
No, he was the one that was in the truck with McVeigh. He got out of the truck and walked over and got in the brown Chevy pickup.
Oh, I see.
I mean, that's the way I understand it.
I
could be wrong, but
what about allegations about the white supremacists? I know that right after the bombing happened, the media focused heavily on the militia movement and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that probably came from Clinton. He didn't like Rush Limbaugh or any of the stuff that he was coming out with, and didn't like the militias. And they tried to make it appear that the militias were involved, and they couldn't find that the militias had done a single thing wrong. But it took the heat off of the Middle Easterners.
Right. I have to admit to you, sir, I've read quite a bit about this, but I haven't been able to get a copy of y'all's final report yet. So,
oh, you haven't?
No, I actually haven't been able to find a copy for less than $100 anywhere.
Of our book?
Yes, the final report of y'all's investigation commission, right?
Oh, you can call and get it for, I think it's $34.95.
Oh, yeah, that's not too bad. Well, so in that book, do you guys go into the Elohim City and the neo-Nazis out there in eastern Oklahoma?
Yeah.
My understanding from reading Ambrose Evans Pritchard from the Daily Telegraph was that the neo-Nazis out there had a lot to do with Timothy McVeigh and perhaps the plot here.
They have one piece of evidence that put him, I think, within 8 miles of that compound. It was a ticket that he got, speeding ticket from the highway patrol. I don't have any knowledge of anybody ever seeing him at the compound. We had the young lady from Tulsa that penetrated the, she went in as a confidential informant for the ATF, Carol Howe, and she never said anything about seeing McVeigh in there. She was dating this was Dennis Mahon at the time, who was head of the White Aryan Resistance Movement. And there was a lot of talk about the Elohim City, was the name of the compound over there in eastern Oklahoma, almost on the Arkansas line. But I don't know that we've got any direct connection.
In Pritchard's book, The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, the first section deals with Oklahoma City. And in there, he writes about a reporter named J.D. Cash. Do you know him?
Uh-huh. J.D. Cash wrote for the McCurtain County News over in Idabel.
Okay. And in Pritchard's book, he says that J.D. Cash basically fooled this guy, Dennis Mahon, into believing that he was also a white supremacist and bought him a fifth of whiskey. And they drove around, and that Mahon admitted to him that, we had made the bomb, and if you see Mark Thomas or Michael Brescia, tell them to keep their heads down because they're up to it and this too. And And so my understanding was that this guy, Dennis Mahon, had more or less confessed to J.D. Cash. Is that not correct?
Well, that's maybe what he says. I don't know that it's correct or not. There's a lot of stories that come out of there that we haven't really been able to confirm.
Yeah, it's too bad the FBI didn't investigate Elohim City. Maybe we'd have a little bit better information, huh?
Well, they had a Reverend Millar was one of their informers.
I'm sorry, the Reverend? You mean the man in charge at Elohim City over there?
Yeah. See, they were ATF was getting ready to go in there and do a. They were going to do the same thing there they'd done down at Waco, and this handler of Carol Howe was an ATF agent named Angela Finley, and she wanted her job was to do a flyover of the area, and I guess draw a map or whatever they were going to do, and she got the highway patrol plane to take them fly her over there, and she's telling the highway patrolman what they're getting ready to do, and he said, "Whoa, you better talk to the FBI on this before you go in there, because they got one of their own people in there." So that stopped them from going in there, at least so the story goes. They got the ATF, head of the ATF in Tulsa, where the agent Finley operated out of, to get with the FBI here in Oklahoma City, and it turned out that they did have somebody in there, so they canceled their invasion of Elohim City.
That's interesting. So what you're saying, the ATF and the FBI both were investigating the same place at the same time, and the ATF backed off on at the FBI's request, basically.
Right. I think that's exactly what happened.
So then I guess my question about this, what did you say his name was? Reverend
Millar, M-I-L-L-A-R. He was a Canadian.
Okay, and so do we know whether he was a kind of a confidential informant like Carol Howe was, or whether he was actually an agent, like not just an informant, but getting paid for a specific task?
I don't think we really know. We know what was said there in that airplane that day, and it was strong enough that the ATF backed off of going in. I don't think the FBI's ever come out and said what kind of a connection they had with the Reverend Millar. In fact, they may have denied it. But that was the story that we were getting.
Many of the people in the audience, if anybody's ever seen the show Cops, almost everybody in America, I'm sure, has seen the footage of the two Kehoe brothers. They're driving a big blue and white Suburban, and they get in a shootout with some state troopers, I think, up in New Jersey or something. And they play the clip on Cops or Real Stories of the Highway Patrol or whatever all the time. But I remember watching on Court TV, they talked about how during the trial, this is the Kehoe brothers, Chevy and Shane Kehoe, a couple of white supremacists who were, I guess, eventually convicted for that shootout with the cops and also for some involvement with some bank robberies around the West. And apparently it came out at the trial that Chevy Kehoe, on the morning of the Oklahoma City bombing, came into this motel. It was the motel owner testified that he came into the motel at about 6 o'clock in the morning and said, "Something big's going to happen, turn it to CNN." And that when the news of the bombing came over, that he was all joy and elation. And apparently this guy, the Kehoe brothers both, were tied to the same group of neo-Nazis out there at Elohim City.
There's probably some connection between them. The government tried to make it look like McVeigh and Nichols probably got some financial support help from them. Whether they did or not, I don't know. We've never been able to tie them together where there was any really strong confirmation that there was a connection between them. They may have both been fighting for the same thing or said they were pursuing the same thing, but whether they were doing it together or not, we can't confirm that.
Okay. I'd like to ask you something that I remember about during I guess, McVeigh's trial, or maybe it was Terry Nichols' trial. I think it was McVeigh's trial. It came out that there was some discrepancy about the Ryder truck and that, some people supposedly saw it at Geary State Lake, but they didn't see the Yellow Mercury or Terry Nichols' truck or anything anywhere near it. There were other people who said that they saw it at the hotel, but that it changed, that it was a different truck, that You know, one woman I remember testified that she saw it the day before McVay supposedly rented it, and that it was brand spanking new model of truck, and that then another witness said no, it was a faded old yellow one, and that apparently, like, there was some discrepancy as to whether maybe there were two Ryder trucks, one of them a decoy and one of them the actual truck with the bomb, or maybe that the two, one group was shadowing another, and do you know anything about that?
Well, I think there's a real strong possibility that there were two trucks in Oklahoma City that day, and both they both may have been loaded with explosives. We've had some information that indicated that they might have intended to pull another truck up in front of the federal building to the south of the Murrah building, which was where all the courts were, and but evidently it didn't get there because nothing happened there. But that is a very good possibility. The truck that David Snyder saw set down in Bricktown may have been a different truck than Mike Morose saw at 10th and Hudson, because they were there. You're talking about a couple miles apart there, and a lot of all downtown area to get through. And
they both saw them at almost the same time, or
yeah, pretty close to the same time. That's right.
I see.
It makes you wonder.
Yeah, it definitely makes me wonder. I don't know. I got a whole list here of things to ask you about, but I guess I kind of want to stop and ask you about the media. And how is it that people are hearing this story from you for the first time today, and how come we haven't known about all this mess for 8 years?
Well, right after the bombing, I did a friend of mine that I played golf with worked for that Channel 4, and they called me and asked me if I'd come down and do an interview with them, said they couldn't find anybody that was a survivor out of the building to interview. And so I went down, and after that I thought it was just a local program, but it went all over the world. And I did interviews with stations from Cologne, Germany to Honolulu. And to begin with, I was just following the government line, whatever they said. I said, well, you know, maybe it did happen that way, but I'd ask myself, well, you know, how come I didn't hear that truck bomb go off? And they said, well, sometimes the pressure comes in and hits your ears and closes them down before the noise gets there, which doesn't make sense. I mean, if it had done my ears that way, it had done all the rest of those people's ears the same way.
I mean, you said that you felt all the shaking before you ever heard anything, right?
Well, yeah, and what that is, if you, when you get our report, there's a report in our report that retired Brigadier General Benton K. Parton wrote that tells how the building really came down.
I have it right here. I have his letter to Senator Trent Lott anyway.
Yeah, okay, well that's essentially the same thing that I experienced, was exactly what he said happened. And to back up what he's saying has happened, you know, all you have to do is go to the University of Oklahoma Geology School seismograph, and it'll show a 7 to 9 second difference in time between the first blip and the second blip. And that's probably about the length of time. Of course, it's a little bit less than the 7 seconds if that's when the truck bomb went off, because I was knocked out before it went off and didn't hear it. But, you know, there's all kinds of confirmation of what I felt from other people. Jack Gobin down on the fifth floor is head of the Department of Agriculture. He said he felt the building start shaking, and having worked in California for a number of years, they were always told to get under their desk. He was under his desk when the truck bomb went off.
I have that audio clip, and in fact...
Do you really?
Yeah, when we're done, I don't have the setup to where you could hear it if I played it, but the audience will hear that clip of him walking bloody down the street explaining...
Right, it's a TV.
...how he got under the desk.
So if you weren't under that desk, you wouldn't have made it.
Well, my floor was okay, and the ceiling had come down, but there was still concrete above, so it was just a corner of the office that was left that we were in. Everybody else that we worked with is gone.
Are you okay? Just the corner of your office was okay, and the rest of the floor was completely flattened?
And we could go over the edge and look, and you could see the sky and as far down as you can look, and just the hole.
And which floor were you on?
Fifth.
On fifth?
Fifth floor.
So just the one corner of the fifth floor wasn't completely flattened.
I don't know what the building looks like.
Did everybody just crawl out of the death
shaft?
It was like slow motion. We crawled under before the glass part was coming, and everything it just seemed to roll in on us. I thought it was an earthquake when it started. It was just a kind of a shake, and then everything started going like this, and I dove under the desk, and then all the glass came in, and the ceilings came down, and I probably got cut worse if I hadn't been under the desk. I just got little scrapes and scratches. I was really lucky.
Really lucky.
Jack's a friend of mine. He's a nice fella, and been with the Department of Agriculture for a number of years.
The multiple bombs thing, I guess we should stick with that for a minute here. Now, General Parton says that there were four bombs planted inside the building attached to the columns. Is that correct?
That's what I would say, because the four columns that came down, the closest one to the bomb was 15 and a half feet away, if you read the FEMA report. And according to General Parton's, and he was head of explosive research development for the Air Force, a brilliant man, he says that the formula that you use to determine the blast pressure at different distances from the center of the blast, it was calculated like this. It drops off at a negative cubed amount. So for each foot that you get away from the center of that blast, it dropped off a negative cubed amount. And at 15 and a half feet, he calculated it out, it was dropped down to 375 pounds per square inch pressure. Well, your atmospheric pressure at sea level is 14.7, I think. So 375 pounds is a lot of pressure. But when it's going up against a 4,000-pound test concrete column that's 24 inches by 36 inches with 20-inch and 3/8 steel reinforcing bars in it, it doesn't mean anything. It can't bring a concrete column down.
Right. Well, and you're just talking about the very closest column to where
right.
the truck was parked, right?
Exactly.
How many columns failed at the building total?
Well, there was four of them that came down, and that was the closest one. The next closest one would have been about 30, probably 40 feet away, and then that one column was 60 some feet away, and it didn't even take the sheetrock off the other columns closer to it, but yet it brings that column down, supposedly.
Wow.
You can't do that. It'd drop down to something like 70 pounds per square inch pressure by the time it got out there, or less.
That would have to be a really neato magical explosion to get stronger as it travels through the air, I guess, huh?
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. Like the magic bullet in the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, no. Let's not bring up Arlen Specter now. Oh, boy.
The magic things happen.
I'll tell you what, yeah, I mean, the idea of an explosion traveling past one column and leaving it untouched, even leaving the sheetrock on it, and then knocking down the column past it, that's got to strain some credulity somewhere.
Well, the column that went down was further away from the truck than the column that I was right next to.
That's incredible.
And my column, if, of course, my column had gone down, we wouldn't be talking today, but...
Well, so do we think that McVeigh and his buddies put the bombs in there, or who had access to a federal building to plant bombs on columns?
Anybody? We had no security in that building. It was probably the Middle Eastern terrorist group out of Las Vegas that was involved in that, and the government never investigated them. They had a confidential informant that was working within the group. And that's part of the evidence that we're using in the lawsuit that we filed against the Republic of Iraq. There's 24 of us that are involved in that lawsuit. Kerry Gagin was a confidential informant for federal law enforcement in Denver. He'd been running drugs for this Middle Eastern terrorist group out of Las Vegas. Started finding explosives mixed in with his drugs. Went in there and said, "Hey, boys, what's going on?" He said, "I'm running drugs, not explosives." And they said, "Well, we're getting ready to blow up a federal building. We'll pay you $250,000 to help us." He said, "Oh, well, let me think about that." And he jumped on a plane, flew right into Denver, and went in and told federal agencies there what was going on. He said, "You know, you guys may get me for running drugs, but you're not going to get me for blowing up federal buildings. I'm out of this." They said, "Oh, no, no, we want you to stay in so we can monitor him." He said, "All right, give me a letter of immunity." He got a letter of immunity. I've got copies of all of his documents. And he documented everything that he did. That was on September the 14th of 94 that he got his letter of immunity. On March 27th of 95, he took a letter into the U.S. Marshal's office in Denver, Tina Rao, who was his contact as a confidential informant. In that letter, he told him, said, I got information there's going to be a federal building blown up in Denver or a city nearby. Within 30 days, call me at this number. He said, I stayed at that number 2 days. Nobody ever called me. In fact, as a matter of fact, he said they never treated me like they're supposed to handle a confidential informant. They're supposed to polygraph them. They're supposed to follow them, check them, you know, make sure they're doing what they're supposed to do. They never did that with him. Then again, on the 3rd of April, he got called to a meeting by this Middle Eastern group, terrorist group, and said there were six other guys in the room besides him, two Caucasians, two Latinos, and the two Middle Eastern guys that he worked for. And he said, I didn't understand Arabic, so I didn't know what they were talking about up at this table, but they had a set of plans on the table, and they called me up there finally, and I got to look at it, and it's a set of plans of the Murrah building. So he thought, well, I better go back in and talk to, and let the federal law enforcement in Denver know what I found out. So he flies back into Denver and has a friend of his hand carry a letter down there. He was afraid to take it down there this time because he's afraid the Middle Easterners might be watching him. He sent another letter down there. He said, I've got new information that there's going to be a federal building blown up in Denver or a city nearby within 2 weeks. He said, if you don't call me this time, you won't hear from me again. He's a little irritated with him. And he said, I left the phone number. I said, call me at this number. He said, I stayed there 2 days. He said, I couldn't stay any longer. He said, they never called me. And everybody said, well, you know, this guy's not very credible, but, you know, he said the building's going to be blown up within 30 days. He said on the 27th of March, he said on the 6th of April, it was going to be blown up within 2 weeks.
Sounds pretty credible to me.
Sounds credible as hell to me.
Are we talking about, I mean, is this cover-up just so that the government can save face because they can't admit how many clues they had that they didn't follow up? I mean, this is an incredible cover-up. The information that you're bringing out, the fact that this has never been on 60 Minutes, you know, I've never seen Ed Bradley interview this Kerry James Gagan guy. I mean, are they just saving face, or did they want this to happen, or what's going on here?
Well, I wish I knew. That's the reason I'm still presented. I want the truth. You give me the truth, I'll play golf 7 days a week instead of four. But until I get the truth, I'm going to be presented. We haven't accomplished our goal yet, but our name is out there, the Oklahoma Bombing Investigating Committee, and people that have real information that they've taken to the FBI that they've totally disregarded are coming to us with that information now. And we, at least we're giving people that do have some information a place to bring it where we may have a chance of getting the truth out about what happened. I think that's a plus for our committee. And we don't have a lot of funds to work with, but, we've got four people in the committee that are determined to get to the truth, and we will use our time and what few resources we do have to pursue it.
Well, I'm sure glad you are. I know, you know, there's a lot of people around the country, I'm sure, who have the interest, but not the time, the money, or the inclination to, you know, go and be their own investigators. And the fact that y'all have set up this committee to be kind of the clearinghouse for all this information, I know is a great help to a lot of people. Are there any other books or newspapers, anybody else that has done a good job with this that you can recommend to people to talk about?
Craig Roberts is in his book, The Medusa Files. He has a section on the Oklahoma City bombing. Colonel Bo Greitz has got a new book coming out. I've got a draft copy of it here. I had to go over some of the stuff to make corrections. He wanted me to look at it and make sure that what he had in there was correct. And I don't know exactly when he's going to get it published, but it shouldn't be too much longer. His book's going to have, I think, 25, 26 chapters on different events, like the Randy Weaver thing when he went up and brought him down.
Right.
Just one chapter of it's going to be on the Oklahoma City bombing, but he covers it pretty well. Stephen Jones book, Others Unknown, I think is the name of it. So, you know, to begin with, I didn't think too much of old Stephen Jones, but he's given us quite a bit of help on our lawsuit against Iraq, giving us information that we didn't have.
Now that McVeigh's dead, is he free to go ahead and tell you everything he knows about McVeigh? I know,
yeah.
You know, in his book, I know he couldn't write about McVeigh at all. It was sort of the Oklahoma bombing minus McVeigh in that book, but he can tell you everything now, right?
The first book was that way, but now he's when McVeigh fired him and hired the new attorneys, that put him in a little different light. We just did a radio or a TV show that's going to come out over PBS any time now.
On PBS?
Yeah.
Is that for Frontline or?
It's Jerry McHouston, or Dennis McHouston up in Dallas is the producer. And he has some backers, financial backers that have these tax-free foundations,
yeah.
foundations that are supporting him. And Charles Key and I went down, and we paired with Stephen Jones and Danny Coulson, who was the FBI agent that was in charge of the investigation here. They're doing two one-hour segments that are going to be coming out any time on the public broadcasting system.
Excellent. And what was his name again?
Dennis McHouston is the producer there in Dallas. And
I'm going to see if I can't get a hold of him.
Oh, he's a good guy. I think a lot of Dennis. He's trying to get the truth out. And he's presenting both sides of it. That's the reason he had the FBI agent there. But there was also another FBI agent there that the FBI had fired. That I'd heard about him, and I think he's a pretty damn good guy. In fact, I think he lives right there outside of Austin. And I talked to him for a while, and I asked him, I said, well, why'd they fire you? I mean, I've heard the story, but I'd like to hear what you have to say. And if I remember right, he said that he was outposted to another town here in Oklahoma that did investigations over in the eastern part of the state, and part of his investigation uncovered a Middle East connection to the bombing. And in his 302 that he sent back into the office, he had all that information, and they sent it back to him, said, destroy it and forget that you ever heard about it.
Is this the agent that Dan Rather interviewed right before McVeigh's execution, where there were three or four agents on CBS? I remember that. I remember those guys. And they were saying that this was when, for the audience who might not remember, right before McVeigh's execution, the FBI admitted that they had boxes and boxes full of information that they never gave to the defense, and so they postponed his execution for a little while. And then these FBI agents came forward on 60 Minutes and said, hey, you know, I know for a fact that the stuff that I turned in still hasn't been given to the defense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the ones, Dan Vogel, Rick Ojeda, I can't remember the other two, but just before, probably the reason that happened was Jane Graham and I filed a lawsuit in Terre Haute, Indiana to stay McVeigh's execution. She was on the ninth floor of the building that day and survived. And she's a strong lady. Her daddy was a vice president under Jimmy Hoffa. she doesn't run scared of anybody.
No, I guess not.
We filed that lawsuit. Well, about a few days after we filed the lawsuit, then this information comes out. Oh, yeah, we got 4,000 pieces of evidence here that we forgot all about giving to the defense. And so then Mr. Ashcroft comes in, gives an administrative stay, which supersedes our request for a stay. But his stay is running out on the 16th of June, and we have to have a new request for our stay back in there at least 10 days before the execution. Our attorney in Dallas, who had filed it electronically before and didn't have any problem getting it through, he files it 12 days ahead of time, but somehow they just didn't get it on time.
Oh, isn't that a shame?
Yeah, imagine that. They wanted McVeigh dead as fast as they could get him dead.
Yeah, and you know, it's something that, you know, the first execution by the federal government since, what, 1970-something, 71, 72, something like that. And it was based on a Russian-style show trial where 4,000 pieces of evidence are omitted, where they bring in a British explosives expert to testify about the bomb because every single FBI agent from the crime lab is fired for being a criminal and a forger of evidence. Carol Howe, the ATF informant, is not allowed to testify. I mean, we're talking about a total joke of a trial that was that sentenced a man to death for the first time the federal government had executed somebody in, or legally anyway, in 30 years.
Yeah, the trial should have been in Oklahoma. They violated his constitutional rights when they moved it. When they killed him, it was destruction of evidence, and that's obstruction of justice. That was the basis for our lawsuit. And, of course, he's gone. Now, we got Terry Nichols up here in our county jail. They're wanting to try him for the other 160 deaths. McVeigh was just tried for the deaths of the 8 federal agents.
Right.
Now they want to try Nichols. He got a life sentence up there for conspiracy to participate in the Mirabelling bombing. Which a vote from the jury was 10-2 for acquittal to begin with. They had two people that held out.
I actually have the clipping here where the jury forewoman says that there were, of the two guys who voted guilty, that they made them cry. That was the quote from one of the guys who voted to convict in the first place was, they all wanted to acquit, but we told them, we made them cry, and they ended up agreeing. And so then they convicted him, but only of involuntary manslaughter, right?
Yeah, this Nikki Deutschman was the foreperson of the jury, a very bright lady, and very articulate. I can remember the afternoon that occurred, there was two or three other people on the jury that was supposed to go with her to meet the press. They all bailed out on her, and she was out there by herself. And I tell you what, she did a superb job. She's a very bright lady.
I mean, it seems to me, and you know, this is just my own personal point of view, it seems to me that Terry Nichols is probably guilty of first-degree premeditated murder and the whole bit, but that the government couldn't afford to give him a real trial and really display all the evidence against him without leading to a bunch of other stuff.
Well, it would lead to the Middle East connection because we found out since then that he was probably more heavily involved than McVeigh, and all those trips he was making over to the Philippines, Cebu City, you know, he married a little Marifay, the mail order bride, but he was going over there when she was over here. And he was meeting with Ramzi Yousef and Edwin DeAngelis, who was the Middle Eastern terrorist leader there in Cebu City.
And now Ramzi Yousef, he's the guy sitting in prison for the first World Trade Center bombing right now, correct?
Exactly. But he didn't go in there until after the Mirabelling bombing. And we've got some other things. I can't talk about it on... I don't want to go public with it yet because we got some guys that could get hurt. But when we get involved in our lawsuit there in Washington, I'm going to try to get this information out, and it's going to tie the Middle Easterners into the Mirabelling bombing very tightly.
Wow. Yeah, I remember in Stephen Jones' book, I think he talked about how they actually had people in the Philippines who were willing to travel to the United States to testify under oath that Terry Nichols was there with Ramzi Yousef in bomb-making school or whatever there.
They called him the farmer.
But was it Judge Mache, the judge in the case, wouldn't let this witness come here to testify?
Judge Mache would not allow Stephen Jones to present any evidence that was connected to the Middle East. There's something wrong with that kind of a order coming from a federal judge. It sounds like the department is more like a Department of Injustice instead of the Department of Justice.
It's sounding more and more like that all the time.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I just want to end with, I want to get your comment on this quote. I have a quote here from Judge Burkett, who oversaw the county grand jury investigation that Glenn Wilburn and them got started. And when they were done rubber-stamping the FBI's version of what happened there, Judge Burkett said, quote, hey, more than a billion records were reviewed. 35,000 personal interviews worldwide, and basically referred to this giant pile of evidence that the FBI had investigated. And if the FBI doesn't believe in these silly conspiracy theories involving Middle Easterners or white supremacists or anybody else, after going through all of that volume of information, then why should you?
Well, I think that the answer to that goes back to the agent that we talked about that was investigating things in the eastern part of Oklahoma that had run onto a Middle East connection to the bombing, sending the information in to the office here in Oklahoma City. It's being sent back to him saying, destroy it and forget it. You know, don't make any difference if you've done a billion, investigated a billion pieces of evidence. If you aren't going to use it, you can't get to the truth. The truth's still getting hung out.
So we're talking about a difference between quantity and quality of
exactly,
information.
Exactly. It's like the FBI lab. They're so bad they can't even get membership in the National Forensic Lab Association. I don't remember the name of it, but that's what it is. And all you got to do is read the IG's report on the FBI lab. And, as a matter of fact, let me back up this a little bit. This TV thing that's coming out on PBS with Dennis McHouston, one of the first things that we said, my story was what I told here a minute ago, you know, that felt the building shake and, you know, that there were other explosive devices in the building. Well, Danny Coulson couldn't wait to get up and refute what I said. He said, Dave Williams from the FBI lab, one of the best investigators that they have, but he and I went all through that building. We could find no evidence of any other explosive devices. And I wanted to jump up and refute them, but we were supposed to have a question and answer session at the end, which we didn't have, so I couldn't refute it on the station. But in between the first hour and the second hour, they fed us a little food, and I'm sitting there, and he comes over and sits down by me and starts talking. I said, hey, you know, you mentioned Dave Williams in there when you were saying that there couldn't have been any other explosives in there. Are you talking about that Super Dave that they call him, the one that they had to fire and get him out of the lab? Because his work was sloppy and he commingled evidence. And he said, what do you know about that? I said, well, have you read the FBI's own report, the IG's report on the FBI lab? If you haven't, then you don't know what I'm talking about. You ought to go read it. And about that time, Charles Key came over. He said, Danny, he said, I think the problem is we know more about this bombing than you do.
Yeah, clearly.
And at least we're...
That's Danny's job, is to remain ignorant so that he doesn't have to do his job.
Yeah, I think that's a good possibility. He's a nice guy. I liked him. He's going to give me a copy of his book. He's got a book out. I'll read it. I'd like to see what he says.
I mean, this guy, Dave Williams, if he's such a great forensic examiner, we all have to question how come he wasn't good enough for the prosecution in the McVeigh or the Nichols trial.
Exactly. Yeah, Dr. Whitehurst, his book, they had a book called Tainting Evidence. There's a good book for you to read. It's by Kelly and Hearn, I believe it is, or Wern. And the name of it is Tainting Evidence. Most of it is on the FBI lab. In fact, all of it's just about on the FBI lab.
And now Frederick Whitehurst, he was the guy who was the head of the crime lab and then who got fired for complaining about the manufacturing of evidence in the first World Trade Center bombing, Waco, and Oklahoma City, correct?
Well, he couldn't in Oklahoma City because if they'd have sent him down here, then they could have used his testimony. But they knew that he wouldn't lie. You know, he told me that he proud to stay his life when he walked across the stage and got his diploma from the FBI Academy. But he said, I also signed an oath. I took an oath. And I can't violate my oath. And there was a lot of that going on in the lab. And that's the reason he got fired. Well, of course, he goes and finds him some good whistleblower attorneys, and they go win a settlement out of the FBI. I think it's $1.6 million. While they were pursuing him and trying to make him think he was crazy, sending him to psychiatrists and all this stuff, he went and got a law degree at Georgetown University. He's already got a PhD from Duke. Yeah, he's a brilliant guy and a super patriot. he's one of the proudest things he has hanging in his office are the four awards he got for the Bronze Stars for valor in Vietnam.
You're talking about Dr. Whitehurst.
Yes, right. Dr. Frederick Whitehurst.
And this is the guy who, once he became a whistleblower, was fired, and then when he sued, the federal government settled with him for $300,000, which is...
No, $1.6 million.
Oh, was it that much?
Yep.
Which is absolutely unheard of for suing the federal government. The federal government might give you a few thousand, if anything.
Well, give Randy Weaver's girl $3.2
million. Yeah, well, they definitely had that coming, and then...
Poor old Randy, I felt so sorry for him.
Well, yeah, me too, and, you know, in fact... that's a story for a whole different time. I just interviewed Alan Bach last week on here, the guy that wrote Ambush at Ruby Ridge.
Oh, really? I haven't read that.
Oh, that's an excellent book by Alan Bach. I recommend it at the top of the list. Unfortunately, Mr. Lawton, we've run up against the time wall here. Got an interview with Dick Revis, the author of The Ashes of Waco, coming up in about 10 minutes.
Well, so, I've got a place I got to go, so it's going to work out just right.
All right, well... Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to an interview with Mr. V.Z. Lawton of the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee, and who is himself a survivor of the Oklahoma City bombing. Is there a website that people can look at?
Yeah, but I don't know what it is.
OKCBombing.org, I think.
Yeah, that's it.
We were looking
it.
At it last night.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Chaos today, sir.
Okay, Celebrity. Appreciate it.
This is the Weekend Interview Show. And I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator.
The questions about what happened in Oklahoma City will continue.
Kathy, I know you have been so concerned about this execution because you spent the recent years of your life looking into whether or not there was a conspiracy that was larger than just McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and a couple of others. Do you feel any differently now, having seen this or having gone through the execution this morning?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, this was just a bump in the road on just a bump in the road to me. I feel absolutely no different. There absolutely were other people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing, and I've been working with MTA Films the last 2 years, and we're going to be releasing a documentary entitled A Cry for Justice, The Untold Story, and I think the American people are going to be surprised at what they're going to see.
Clearly there's a conspiracy of some 6 to 8 people, with perhaps another half dozen inadvertently helping. That is to say, they didn't precisely know what the objective was.
Agents forewarned about a bomb in Oklahoma City. Did they know the Murrah Building was a target? The ATF says no, absolutely not. But tonight in the story you'll see only on the news channel, you're about to hear otherwise from people who were at the Murrah Building that morning.
We asked some simple questions and we can't get any answers, so it makes us that much more curious, you know. Where the hell were they?
The news channel did ask for a private meeting with ATF officials to discuss the credibility of these witness reports, but the ATF refused, saying they had no more to say on the subject.
What he told him is that he thought that they had received a tip that morning of the bomb.
Yet another witness, a rescue worker, says after she talked with an agent at the bombing scene, she also suspected the ATF was warned and agents stayed away from their office that morning.
I asked him if his office was in the building, and he said yes. And I asked if there were any ATF agents that were still in the building, and he said no, we weren't here.
Witness number one approached an ATF agent nearby. He claims he asked the agent what had happened, and witness number one says this is what the agent told him.
He started getting a little bit nervous. He tried reaching somebody on the two-way radio. Couldn't get anybody, and I told him I wanted an answer right then. He said they were in the briefing. None of the agents had been in there. They had been tipped by their pagers not to come into work that day. Plain as day out of his mouth. They were tipped. Why wasn't anybody else? There was a lot of people, good people, died down there. And if they knew, they should have let everybody else know.
My scene, McVeigh was with another person.
Do you have any doubt in your mind that there was a passenger in the Ryder truck?
That's even more. I have no doubt there was definitely a second person, no matter what. There was two people in this vehicle.
John Doe number 2, and there was a $2 million price put on his head. And now they're saying there's no John Doe number 2.
All witnesses picked out a photo lineup. The news channel shared the information and surveillance tapes of this man with the FBI. They've had some of that material long before our reports went on the air. We asked if Dan Vogel with John Doe number 2 is still part of the investigation. Does he exist? The answer, yes. The FBI is still trying to locate and identify John Doe number 2. The man in our reports is Iraqi. Today, the FBI says they are not pursuing a Middle Eastern connection. This doesn't mean it has been ruled out. That could change tomorrow.
And the details are chilling. We'll also focus on surveillance cameras, cameras that caught the bombing on tape, and maybe the men behind the bombing. The news channel has new information tonight that there's a chance surveillance tapes could be the smoking gun evidence. Now, we asked candid questions in a rare face-to-face meeting with ATF officials close to the investigation. We learned that video collected from downtown businesses the morning of April 19th may someday be played before a jury. Officials won't say who or what exactly is on the tape. However, numerous sources have confirmed that tapes exist and that they reveal more than one bomber.
So what evidence are they asking for? They're asking for video taken from the rider checks from the Regis Towers. Sure. Well, Kevin, it's a question we've all been asking. We've been asking that question since we first broke the story that surveillance cameras aimed at the federal building could have captured all those involved on tape. Now, sources have confirmed those tapes exist and that they show more than one bomber. The FBI also confirmed those tapes exist when they refused to release them. Claiming the video is part of a criminal investigation. And now, for the first time, we get an on-the-record response from the head of the Dallas office, ACS. We learned that videotape could be unveiled as part of the prosecution's case. No officials will discuss specifically what's on the video, but we have been able to recreate some of what may have been captured by downtown surveillance cameras through the eyes of the witnesses. Now, we're looking at a computer recreation of the final movements of the Ryder truck, according to the people who crossed its path at Ship and Harvest, moments before the explosion. Tonight at 10, the witnesses will detail their memories of how they believe the suspects carried out the crime and made their getaway. To all these accounts, there are common and unsettling similarities. The witnesses say they saw several accomplices, including the infamous John Doe number 2. ATF officials tell us the elusive John Doe is still part of this case, but will not comment any further.